back out. You get the two big clamps, and you jury rig a setup to get into your rig. And plus, it also has the cigarette lighter, plug. You can plug anything in like that as well. So you got that USB now, and of course the big clamps. Yeah, you need the bigger clamps if you're going to run, a 50 watt rig or something. You don't want to run that off the little cigarette plug. I don't think that would take it. And that's it. It got little lights on it, and it tells you how much power you have left in the battery, how charged it is. And then your emergency light, LED light, that would work forever if you needed it. So it's good. I actually have two of them now. The one I thought was getting older, so I bought another one. But the other one is still good. I like the new one because of the USB port.
That sounds like a darn good thing to have, Paul. That's extra auxiliary battery pack. You're a belt and suspenders man. The fact that you've got that, I think you're going to be kind of a rare one. Although this is a good idea if we thought about it, not many of us have been exposed to that. I bet you if I did a survey with the people who are on the net tonight, not many of them will say that they own one of these auxiliary battery packs. I'm going to send it back to Craig. He's going to give a little bit of delay in case anybody's going to tell us that, hey, I've got one of those too. So KD2OGB, with a little bit of delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2OGB, a battery booster pack I've had on my list of things to do for a while. I just haven't got around to it, but I definitely would like to own one of those so I don't have to rely on using my own car if I have to jump somebody else, which I had to do a couple days ago, actually, while out by the docks in Patchogue. My 1999 Jeep Wrangler, the battery was also overcharging, mainly because terminals were so incredibly corroded, because those terminals are going to take a lot more electricity to run through because they're corroded, and that creates heat, and the alternator will have to keep recharging the battery at a higher rate, it'll get hot, and I was told if the battery overcharges long enough, that can actually make the battery blow up, I was told. And that's something I would not want to even hope to have happen.
Yeah, very few batteries are so high in impedance and so good. I mean, you can put high current into a battery as if you're overcharging it. And when it finally comes up to full charge, the voltage will start climbing. I think there are very few properly operating car batteries that you could get to go to 19 volts, real voltage on the battery, not just a phony voltage because of a poor resistance on the battery clip on the battery, the contact. And the alternator can easily put out 19 volts, but it's not supposed to go there. And you are good to turn that off. You don't want to sit in that condition very long. And so did you get a chance to check whether or not there was any corrosion or cleanliness required on the contacts on the battery? Back to you, Craig, K2RIW.
Yeah, my dad actually fixed it all. And actually, no. The alternator can actually put as high as 80, 90 volts alternating current into the battery if those diodes that convert it to DC power stop working. They're called alternators for a reason, because they create alternating current, and the diodes convert it into DC current. So that could also be the reason for the overcharge. And plus, I ditched the old Jeep because the frames were so rusted they wouldn't pass inspection and the transmission was almost ready to go out.
Yeah, where Joe before was asking us to put the AC probe, in other words, run your digital voltmeter in the AC mode to look at the ripple on the battery. And if you do see any ripple, there's two things that can cause the ripple. One, high impedance of the battery. High meaning, a milliohms instead of a microohm. If that gets to be a microohm, and as it starts getting up to milliohms and ohms, the pulsating voltage coming out of the alternator will give you ripple on that battery and give you an indication. However, there is a mode of alternator failure where the alternator really is a three-phase winding, and it's got the a six diode arrangement which can give you full wave rectification of the three phases. And one of the modes of failure of an alternator is where one of the phases fails. You got two phases working and one phase not working. and now you're not getting continuous voltage out of that rectifier, and you're getting a great big gap, and that will give you a phony ripple. On top of that, you don't get the normal 90 or 100 ampere maximum. You get some much, much smaller numbers. So one of the modes of failure I had of an alternator is that when it was hot, one of the phases would become a short circuit. And it only happened when it was hot. So when you brought the alternator in to be checked, they were checking it. When I traded it in, they would do a check to see if it was a non-confirmed complaint, and they would put it back on the shelf because they didn't run it long enough during their check to get it hot, and they never saw that intermittently failing winding. And so that particular alternator kept going round and round and round, if you know what I mean. So, alrighty. I think it's time to go on to the next person, Craig. And good luck with all your voltage situations. We're going to go over to John next. N2 Sierra Lima Whiskey. You've got it, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Believe it or not, I have a battery question.
We're looking forward to it.
I want to install an auxiliary battery in the car just to power a 2 meter 440 radio. And I don't want to wire it directly into the car's wiring harness. I want to be able to charge it through the cigarette lighter plug. Can you give me any advice or any admonish me in some way and convince me not to do this? I'm open for suggestions.
OGB's comment.
Yeah, first of all, your OGB recognized. You got to be careful with that cigarette lighter plug. Quite often it has rather light gauge wiring. It can't tolerate very much current without a failure. And sometimes some of those cigarette lighter plugs give you a significant voltage drop. Your battery is putting out 14 volts, and you may only get 11.5 volts if it's on cigarette lighter plug under current. Some automobiles have two separate cigarette lighter plugs. One's really intended for the cigarette lighter, and the other one's intended for running auxiliary equipment. That one is quite a bit better. OGB, go ahead, K2RIW.
KD2OGB, do not use the cigarette lighter. You're dealing with constant amperage. To find a battery that could deal for a long period of time to power that radio and then find a way to charge that battery, or you would have to link it directly into the car battery. Because when I very first installed my radio for the very first time in my Ford Explorer, I asked a friend of mine if it could be done through the cigarette lighter, and he said, no, don't do it. Hook it up directly to the battery, and I'll help you out with it. That's what he said. KD2OGB.
There is, let me drop. There is a rare aftermarket item you can buy, which is a high-power Schottky diode, where you can set up things in such a way that wiring-wise, with the diode, it looks like the auxiliary battery is connected across the regular battery. But with that diode in the circuit, only when the regular battery voltage is above your auxiliary battery voltage, current will flow through the diode and keep your auxiliary battery charged. But because of the presence of the diode, when you're discharging the auxiliary battery, because of running electronic equipment, the diode will not allow it to kill the other battery. You'd like to have one battery there always guaranteed to be there so you can run your starter motor. So with the diode, you can set things in such a way that the auxiliary battery will be charged, but it's not capable of discharging the regular battery that runs the starter motor. But as I said, high-power Schottky diode, which comes with a heatsink, that's a rare aftermarket item. I can't remember the name of the catalogs that I used to have of automobile parts that it listed that. I don't think you can walk into your ordinary Mobile Trends, your AutoZone store, and buy that thing. I think it's a rare item. Anybody got any comments? Has anyone else ever seen that diode, which you can use for the secondary battery? K2RIW and the TechNet listening.
AHK.
AHK, Go ahead, Chester. You've heard about that item, and have you ever owned one? You got it, Chester.
Yeah, it's called a battery isolator, and it has heat sink fins on it. You get them in RV vehicles. They have two batteries, usually, exactly what you say. It'll have a small voltage drop, like a half a volt, going to the auxiliary battery, and you can run all your equipment on the RV vehicle with the second battery. As you say, the primary battery, the starting battery that runs the car, will never be discharged. So they call it a battery isolator. They usually operate somewhere around 150 to 200 amps, possibility of, of getting charged. They can handle the load of anything on the other side, on the secondary battery, but it never draws anything from the primary battery. So you could run that battery down to almost zero if you had to, and your car will never be affected. You could still start up your vehicle. So it's called a battery isolator. Actually, you can get them in J.C. Whitney, stuff like that. That's exactly what it's called, battery isolator. Over.
Boy, that's good to know, Craig. I mean, Chester. Boy, that's good to know. Battery isolator. So it will not allow you to discharge the primary battery when you run the electronics. You've always got the starter motor primary battery held in abeyance, held in a protected manner. Isolator. Roughly how expensive is that, and how recently have you seen it? Do you think it's still an item you can buy? And I think you said the RV people have it, so I guess if you go to a place that sells RV equipment, they've got this. So, Chester, what do you believe was the cost of that thing, and how recently have you seen it available? Did the B2 AHK, K2RIW in the TechNet?
WB2HK. Well, it's people currently use them. They use them in ambulances too, emergency vehicles. You can go on eBay. You can buy it. I'm going to guess battery isolator that can handle 100 amps will probably cost you about $50-$60. You don't need anything too heavy. something that'll handle hundreds of amps. You want to operate your mobile radio. If you had like an RV vehicle or a vehicle where you can put the secondary battery, not in your car, under your wife's legs as she's driving around, you have a battery there. If you want to mount it in the trunk, a lot of the stereo guys have those too. Stereo places have those things. You can go where they install stereos. And these guys run 1,000-watt amplifiers, and they don't want to have a car that doesn't start. So that's a place to go. Go to a stereo installation place. And they probably have it on the shelf. Go ahead.
Yeah, they might charge you a little bit more for it, but right now we're looking for the item, and the exact number of dollars we pay is not so important. So battery isolator. Boy, that sounds like the right way to go. I wonder if you've got a mental schematic and a philosophy schematic of what we're talking about, John. That might be right with just what the doctor ordered. N2SLW. With any further questions, go right ahead, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you. I understand battery isolator. What I was planning to do mostly is I use the radio when the car's not running. So right now I'm in the car with the radio and the car's not running. And I was going to use the auxiliary battery for that, mostly. But what I'm concerned about is charging the auxiliary battery. And I wanted to use a cigarette lighter for that. And I'm wondering if I can work out some way to hook up turn the cigarette lighter lead into a constant current source and use it as a charger for the auxiliary battery. Any thoughts on that?
You could do it, but I don't recommend it for a couple of reasons. The battery isolator with the secondary battery is the nice way to go, where you never, even though you're using your electronics too long, you're not discharging your main battery, and you always have a starter motor. The cigarette lighter plug has a number of problems. It's usually got light wiring, can't dish out very much current, gives you a lot of voltage drop, and the thing that you plug into it, quite often the center pin of the of the male plug that you use with a cigarette lighter. It has a fuse in the center, and that fuse is not good for very many amperes. So the wiring and the internal mechanism of the male plug that you use on a cigarette lighter, that can be troublesome. So go ahead and use the cigarette lighter plug temporarily, but don't make it a permanent installation. This isolator is the right way to go. And with that isolator, you can keep your auxiliary battery charged when you're running the automobile. And when you're running the electronics and the automobile is not running, you're always saving your primary battery. Over to you, John. John, do wait for the beeps. N2SLW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. Ned, thank you very much. I think the information you've given me is very helpful, and I hope to augment it soon. And with that, N2SLW, I'm clear.
And as you go through the steps of installing that and using it, please come back and let us know how it worked. I mean, if it works well, we'd like to know about it. If it doesn't work well, then we'd like to hear your symptoms of it not working well so we know what to look for and what to be careful of. And it looks like now that we know that there is such a thing as a battery isolator, it's really a diode isolator, it's something to know to look for, even though it's a little bit rare in some of the places where we normally go to. Okay, Rich, number two is next. WB2GXM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich, number two.
K2RIW in the group, WB2 Golf X-ray Mike. Before I ask my question, N2EL mentioned the Hamfest. Was the Limark Hamfest today?
No, I think it's a different one. Was it Nutmeg, or what's the name of the Hamfest that was on today, Rich, if you happen to be there? N2EO, K2RIW? Slim chance it was Hall of Science, but I don't think so. Anybody on frequency know where the Hamfest was today? It wasn't Limark, I know that. So where was the Hamfest today? Anybody on frequency can tell us? K2RIW listening?
Meriden, Connecticut, Nutmeg Hamfest, KC1SAM.
Very good, Sam. So it was Nutmeg. So that's the main thing you were looking for, Rich. W2GXM, go right ahead. K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
Okay, thank you, guys. I'm glad I didn't miss the Limark Hamfest. Looking forward to it. Okay, CQ Magazine has an article about Saber V dipole, which is simply a dipole where the wire is kinked into a zigzag shape. And this is the second time I've seen this in CQ Magazine. They specifically say that they can fit a 140-foot dipole for 80 meters or such into a 50-foot space. So that's very interesting. Now, I work for a printer, and I have access to foam core and other materials for free. I could wind this antenna on a form. My question is, if I put 100 or at most 200 watts into this antenna, will there be a fire hazard at the ends of the dipole?
It depends. There's some yeses and noes on all of the above. First of all, a full 80-meter dipole conventionally installed with ordinary straight 14-gauge wire is around 130, 132 feet long. There's a zillion ways you can make the wire, make the antenna physically smaller, but electronically essentially full size. Teleco winding, zigzagging, bending it in various places and whatever, loading coils and so on. As long as you're using low-loss materials, low-ohmic materials, all of that will work and will give you 98% performance, even though you've shrunk it down to, let me pick a number, 50 feet instead of 130 feet. You can get full performance because as long as it is electronically resonated, as you've heard me say so often, the seven most important words in the English language, if you're an antenna designer, is resonate first, then it will radiate. As long as it resonates with low-loss materials, you get full performance. I mean, even a rubber ducky antenna, because it's physically small compared to a true quarter wavelength, everyone thinks a modern-day rubber duck has got low performance. Not necessarily. The bigger antenna you put on your handy-talkie might give you better performance because it's physically longer and the tip of it is higher up in the air. The extra altitude is where the performance is coming from. not because of more gain or affected area of the antenna. Let me drop. But there is another factor that you're onto here, as I see it, Rich, and that is when you make the antenna physically smaller, but yet it's electronically resonant, the Q does go up. In other words, the antenna does run at a higher Q. Higher Q means it's got a slightly more narrow bandwidth and more voltage on the tips. So Q has got about five definitions. Voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, center frequency divided by bandwidth, rise time and fall time, energy stored versus energy dissipated. There's a whole bunch of definitions of the Q. But one of those definitions, and they all work, by the way, if your antenna's got a Q of 10, then it's going to be 10 on all of those methods of measuring. So with a Q of 10, the voltage on the tips is 10 times higher than the average voltage throughout the rest of the antenna. So higher voltage on the end, does that create a fire hazard? If the tips of the antenna are close to something it can arc over to, and if that something is flammable material, yes, it is a potential fire hazard. If the tips are sitting out there with a high-voltage egg insulator, not going near anything that it can arc over to, and not going near any flammable materials, even though the voltage at the tip is high, and every dipole, by the way, is high voltage at the tip, but the physically smaller, higher Q antennas, the voltage at the tips is a little bit higher. As long as there's nothing flammable out there, and you know the voltage distribution. Let me drop. Because of your electronic knowledge, you know that the absolute tip of the antenna has higher voltage, and you treat it more carefully. A good high-voltage insulator, or a piece of nice dry nylon or polypropylene rope, which is a good insulator as long as it's not wet. And then even if it's wet, I'm not quite sure. But as long as there's nothing flammable there that it can arc over to, create local heating, and set that thing on fire. As long as you treat that tip correctly, even though the voltage is high, it doesn't have to be a fire hazard. So there's ways you can work around that, as I see it there, Rich. WB2GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beeps.
Very good, Dick. Sounds right. And actually, I could leave a few feet at the ends of the dipole straight. It would be a little longer, but that would lessen the problems. So, okay, great. K2RIW, WB2GXM.
Whether you bring the helical winding or the zigzagging all the way to the end, that's a minor detail. If the whole antenna, it's the whole length of the antenna that determines whether or not you've raised the Q. If it's normally an 80-meter dipole, 130 feet, and you squeeze it down to 50 feet, you're going to be getting two or three times the normal voltage on the tips, no matter what you do, even if you got a straight section near the end. But you got to be a little bit careful. Don't bring that tip near flammable materials. Don't have things within, let me pick a number, 6 inches. Keep all materials more than 6 inches away from that tip. If it's within 6 inches of the shingles of the house, there's a chance it can arc over to those shingles, and some shingles are potentially flammable. I guess that's a rare one, but you know what I mean. So good luck with that. And when you do build and construct and use that antenna, come back and let us know how it works there, Rich. Okay, the next person on our list, I think that was it Bob? Oh, no, I think it was Russ. KD2, Romeo Mike Delta, K2RIW. Go ahead, Russ.
Evening to everyone on the net and net control. And to give you an update from last week, we were talking, you were helping me with adding an air balance to my coax to get the SWR in my antenna tuner to calm down. And I did that, and the SWR was still up somewhat high, and there was noise coming out of the speaker of my radio, but not as much. And the ultimate culprit was is I forgot that when I had my antenna, my dipole, in my attic, I was using 50-length coax. When I moved it to the bedroom, I simply shortened the coax to my 20-footer because I figured the antenna is going to be right next to the radio on my desk. I don't need the coax. Well, let me drop a sec. Added the longer coax. max 50 foot and everything calmed down with the antenna tuner off. My FWR is about a 1.5, 1.6. I think if I lengthen the antenna, because I believe I shortened it just a little bit too much, it's about 27 and a half feet long on a 20 meter band. My SWR is 1.5, 1.6. It's very good. And my SWR is fine. The antenna tuner, the internal tuner, kicks on just fine. It resonates the antenna quickly, no problems. My 20 meter dipole even resonates on 17 meters. And another problem I had noticed before was my signal strength meter. It would go up to full strength, and then it would back down, and my SWR would creep up. And so I was putting out full power, 100-watt barefoot, then it was backing down and going up and backing down. So the 50-foot length of coax seems to have corrected that. Everything has calmed down. And I did add 5 turns at the Barrowin of an air Barrowin. Only problem is I set the darn fire alarm off yet again yesterday, and now that's a new problem I'm contending with, because that was happening quite regularly when I had the antenna in the attic, when I was having a lot of problems with feedback and RF and everything. So bringing the antenna back to the bedroom, it calmed that down, but I wasn't putting out full power because my SWR was high, so my radio was going into safety mode. And throughout my whole tuning process and troubleshooting, I didn't set the fire alarm off. Once I got everything working and I was back at full power, 100 watts, I set the fire alarm off. So let me get your thoughts on this, because I spoke to my good friend Preston, W2PW, about it. He had a few suggestions. He feels the problem is probably right at the control panel outside. But, what do you think about this one?
Now, well, you and I are trying to figure out whether or not the coax cable with the air balance is still radiating. And maybe it's not. If the air balloon is doing its job, it's acting as such a good RF choke that no substantial amount of current is flowing on the outside of the coax cable, and the coax cable is cold. But still, the dipole is supposed to radiate, and if the dipole is within near field, so to speak, of the fire alarm system and other chunks of electronics, then the dipole doing its job of radiating can be lighting up the fire alarm. And so inverse square law is the only real protection. If you can do whatever you can to make sure that the radiating portion of the dipole, the hot dipole, so to speak, is as far away from the fire alarm system and its wiring. Another thing to worry about, the wiring of that fire alarm system is an antenna, so to speak, picking up radio signals and feeding it into the fire alarm electronics and creating the false alarm. So, and by the way, your air balloon, you made it a couple of turns, and how many turns you made it, what band you're using it on, I think you said you're using it on 20 meters, and so a few turns, a couple of feet in diameter, usually is more than enough inductance to act as a good RF choke, and therefore you're getting all the performance you can get out of your air balloon. And if you wanted to someday later do an experiment with a commercially made balloon, it's also worth a try. But the air balloon is so inexpensive and so easy to do. As belt and suspenders, I think every one of us should be using an air balloon. So the radiating portion of your dipole, how close does it come to the fire alarm system and its wiring? Over you on that one, Warren, I think it is. KD2RMD, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thing starts at the control panel, which is outside, and the fire alarm sensors, they're not smoke detectors, they're fire alarm sensors, and it sends off the horrifically loud bell outside, but the sensors are in the ceiling, and the antenna is relatively close to the sensor. I'm looking at it right now, and that was the focus of the conversation I was having with Preston, is that the wiring within the fire alarm sensors is that sensitive that the radiating dipole seems to be confusing it and setting it off. So we were focusing on the actual wiring of the sensors or the control box outside, if there's a fault somewhere or if it's haphazardly put together. But one thing I forgot to mention to him was, when my radio wasn't putting out one full 100 watts last week, I wasn't having the problem. When I got everything working well, I was back to putting out a full 100 watts, and I set it off again. So now I'm wondering, because I'm not setting it off now, it's simply backing down the RF power, the power by radio, to say medium power, 50 watts. Could something as simple as that rectify the problem? Back to you.
Yeah, whenever you've got a electromagnetic interference problem where something is picking up a signal it shouldn't be picking up and giving you grief, cutting back power will always help. And sometimes that's a good compromise. I mean, going to half power, not getting a problem in the house, is only a 3 dB decrease, and the average guy watching his S meter may not even know that you've gone a little bit more QRP, if you know what I mean. But in many cases, there's a way you can find out how the signal is getting into, say, for instance, your fire alarm system. If you had a 1,000 picofarad disc ceramic bypass capacitor on each of the terminals to ground or to the case of the fire alarm system, on each one of the wires coming out of there, if each one of the wires coming out of your fire alarm system are RF bypass with a 1,000 picofarad disc ceramic, for instance, which probably won't interfere with the wiring of the fire alarm system, but by bypassing the RF energy so that it can't get into the electronics, that can do magic. And also putting ferrites and chokes in the right place can do magic. So almost always there's a way of stopping the electromagnetic interference. But it takes some extra hardware and physically moving things around to affect that. And sorry I called you Warren, Russell, KD2 RMD, K2RW, you got it, Russell.
Good, fine business, and everything that you just said that last go-around was exactly what Preston had said, was somehow figuring out a way to bypass where the fault was, adding capacitance. The question was, where do we do it? Do we focus on the sensors in the attic, the wiring in the attic? Do we go to the control panel? Well, what you had just said was exactly what he had said. So, all right, excellent. So I heard it from two sources, and hopefully simply backing down off the power and going to 50 watts instead of 100 watts will help too. And then I might not even have to go through that work or that trouble. It would be nice to do a full 100 watts power on HF on 20 meters, but if going to medium power is only going to make a couple dB difference, then that is a good compromise. So, listen, thank you again for the help. It's very much appreciated. And real quick, I just want to plug the swap and shop that meets on, I think it's Mondays. It was a few months ago that I was focusing on trying to buy a 10-meter only radio because that's all I could afford. And then another ham, and I forget his name, was offering to swap and sell an ICOM 746. Well, I made that deal, and that's the base radio I'm talking on right now, the ICOM 746. So I just want to plug out a thank you to the good button that does as well. So, KD2RMD, 73s, I'm going to sign for the night. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good sounding rig you're using there right now, Russell. And by the way, when it comes to all the operations you do with bypassing ferrite beads and whatever, do all these operations as close as possible to the real microprocessor. If the microprocessor is in a particular package, that's at that package and at the wiring, at that package is where you do the bypassing and the ferrite beading and whatever. Don't do it far away. At the other end of the wiring, you're wasting your time. The wiring external to the package is an antenna, so to speak, picking up signals and sending them into that sensitive box. So do all your bypassing at the sensitive box where the real microprocessor and other kinds of electronics are. Good luck with all that, Russ. And once you do enough modification of that fire alarm system, I'm almost positive you'll be able to run close to a kilowatt if you want to, without beginning a false alarm of the fire alarm system. Okay, I think Bob is next. WA2 Mike Hotel Lima, I think. Bob, if you're still there, K2RIW, you got it, Bob.
W2. I just wanted to say hello and thank you and how much I enjoy the evening. And I always look forward to Dr. Roy's puzzler. So thank you. Thank you, Jake, and everybody else.
Yeah, I think you're moving around, Bob, because your signal is coming and going, but sounds like you're enjoying things and you're letting us know about that. Sounds like you don't have a real question tonight. Is that true about, by the way, try to find a good location and stay in one location without moving the rig around. WA2 Mike Hotel Lima for any of the comments. K2RIW, go ahead, Bob.
Yes, I have to change this antenna. I forgot to do that before I started listening. Thank you very much, and have a good evening.
Okay, Bob. Alrighty. Let's see, I got around 20 after, approaching 20 after. If we had a whole lot of time left over and very few check-ins, I was going to give you a puzzle. I'm going to hold back on that puzzle tonight. By the way, these puzzles, some people really appreciate puzzles, the guys who just love science. A real scientist wants to know, what is Mother Nature saying to them? What's the real message? How do things really work? A real scientist wants to know that. And there's another kind of human being that doesn't like the fact that these puzzles sometimes are hard to answer. And hard to answer, and the people think that, hey, it's making me look stupid. Let me drop it. That's not it at all. We all have holes in our knowledge that are not our fault. The particular school you went to, the particular environment you were born into, doesn't teach you everything. The best example I can think of is that very few people really know what is the weight or mass of air, a cubic meter of air. Many people think it's very light stuff. It's really 1.2 kilograms. It's over 1 kilogram. 2 1/2 pounds is a cubic meter of air, the stuff that's in the room with you right now. You'd never believe it's that heavy. Many engineers think it's only milligrams and grams, and it's really a kilogram. So we all have holes in our knowledge, but the purpose of these puzzles is this: it fills in those holes. And I've got two very tough puzzles, but I'm not going to give them tonight, or at least not right now. We're going to turn it over to Roy. He's got a puzzle, and he's got some mailbag tonight, so he's got more than enough stuff. And so I'm not eating into his time. Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW. You got it, Dr. Roy.
Okay, very good, Dick. Always a pleasure to be here. And want to repeat to people. One sec, let me just set one little thing slightly different, and I'll be right back.
You're sounding good.
I know, but for some odd reason, the monitor is kind of bleeding excessively. But nevertheless, I want to tell people once again that if they have any mailbag questions for Dick, and we've had two tonight, and they're both about antennas, so that's going to be fun. Or if you have any topics you want me to cover, or subjects, stories, puzzlers that you want to volunteer, because I could always use puzzlers, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to read anything further about stories that I tell you, I'll have links available to them on my webpage, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com, which is my call sign. And we always run this chat room. It's available. There's a bunch of people in it. And if you're interested, a quick way of getting into it is just to go to your web browser and type chat.ac2gs.com, and that will lead you there. In addition, I offer a streaming service for audio. If you somehow can't use the Echo Link and you can't locally listen and you can't get into IRLP, if you type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, you'll get an audio stream of what the signals sound like, at least to my shack. So keep those all in mind. Let me drop, and I'll go to the mailbag. Okay. Chris wrote me. He's an avid scanner guy, shortwave listener, and he wrote that Whistler recently came out with a few desktop broadband scanner antennas. And I sent you a copy of those. And he wants to know, can it be better or much better than a standard rubber ducky antenna for broadband receiving? Now, if anyone would like to look over our shoulder to see what this antenna looks like, I made an alias. If you just go again to your web browser and type antenna.ac2gs.com, it'll show you the page of that particular antenna. But that's Chris's question for tonight, Dick.
A crazy quick question. Do you believe Chris has ham radio call letters? Some people are so bashful they don't use them. Sure, it would be nice to know his ham radio call letters. He could be indicating them on his signature, if you know what I mean. Over to you for a quick one on that one, Roy.
Oh, at this point, he does not. He told me that he's going for his captain's license for his boat, and once he passes that, he intends to study for a ham license, and then he'll have a call sign. And join us all.
Okay, now I think I did look at those antennas that were on that website, and antennas that are made with low loss materials, the physical length of the antenna doesn't matter. As long as it properly resonates, gives you a reasonable standing wave ratio, you'll get full performance out of it. And do you really need a disc cone? I mean, the disc cone, a bigger physical structure, if you can tolerate it, gives you a little bit more bandwidth, but you don't necessarily need that. So I think he's trying to ask us, is one kind of antenna better than the other? Is that sort of what he's asking? Unfortunately, I wasn't paying attention while you were giving the description, Roy. So in a nutshell, is there an either-or question in this particular mailbag question, AC2GS, K2RIW?
I think the gist of it is he has something that he calls a rubber ducky. I'm not quite sure exactly what he means by that, if he means one of those very, very shortened objects that probably are just glorified 50-ohm terminating resistors, or is it just a shortened, somewhat resonant, tandy-talky type of a thing, or what? But that's apparently what he has working on his scanners these days. And he was looking at this cobbled together. It looks to me personally like a bit of a Frankenstein's monster. It has four different electrically lengthened, physically shortened halfway verticals. And that's one model. The other one sticks a disc cone in addition to all that mess. And they spec it to be frequency for reception, whatever that sort of means to them, at 25 hertz to 2,000 hertz, 2,000 megahertz, rather. So, I don't know. It seems like a design made from some marketing department rather than an electrical engineer.
Not necessarily, Roy. The one that's got the four whips to it, or four different sizes for the four different bands, or five different whips, that can be an extremely effective antenna because now you've got the right length on each one of those bands. And although that's a bit of a physical kludge, that could be very high in performance. The disc cone gives you greater bandwidth, but you may not need it because maybe you never listen to the frequencies in between the ham bands. Disc cone gives you a little bit more of that capability. And by the way, when it comes to rubber ducks, everyone believes a rubber duck is low in performance. Not necessarily. A modern-day, well-made rubber duck can be very high in performance. I say that because in the old days, rubber ducks used to be made out of nichrome wire because they thought visual was more important than performance. Nowadays, they don't use nichrome wire in rubber ducks. They use high conductive materials, and the rubber duck runs ice cold and gives you high performance. When you use a longer antenna than a rubber duck, you do get them off. Sometimes you get more performance because the antenna being physically longer, it means that the antenna height off the altitude can always give you more performance. It can almost always give you more performance on VHF, UHF frequencies. Let me drop. Now, rubber ducks themselves, properly used, all have high performance. Many of the brand names of rubber ducks, the manufacturer will ask you what handy talkie you're going to put it on. Each handy talkie manufacturer has his own favorite way of impedance matching the antenna. And whether some of the impedance matching is wrapped inside of the rubber duck, so to speak, or is all inside of the handy talkie package makes a difference. So the possibility exists that a rubber duck that works on a Yaesu will not work very well on an ICOM. handy-talkie, because they have two different kinds of circuits, even though they're both on 2 meters, for instance. One wants the antenna to be more inductive because it's got a greater capacitive loading function inside of its electronics, and the other manufacturer does it the other way. So you can sometimes switch between rubber ducks and see a significant difference in performance, and you think one rubber duck is higher in performance than the other. It's just really that one rubber duck is made to be a better marriage to that particular brand of radio. So some of the random variables you get with rubber ducks, that's part of the explanation. Let me drop. So believe it or not, I like the antenna with the four separate lengths on it. You may not like it physically because of its beauty or lack of beauty, but I think that's a little bit easier to live with than the disc cone. They're both good antennas, but I would prefer that one over the disc cone, I think for physical reasons, and because you don't need all those frequencies in between on the disc cone. On top of that, the possibility exists that, as not to say, do you ever disconnect those other antennas, or do you leave them all connected? I think they leave them all connected at the same time. And I believe that all of those antennas, properly used and properly fed, are capable of giving you 95% performance. Until you get an antenna that's multiple wavelengths long, or Yagi-like structure, which is multiple driven elements all on the same frequency, until you do that, you get no extra gain. So whether the antenna is made by method A, disc cone, or method B, individual resonators, you're both going to be getting close to ground plane or monopole performance out of it, and you're not going to get the 5 dB more gain out of one versus the other. Electronically, they're all a fraction of a wavelength in total length. Therefore, there is no mechanism by which one can give you a hell of a lot more gain than the other. The only thing left is efficiency. If I put 50 watts into the antenna, I'd like 49 of those watts to be radiated into free space. And if they use lossy materials or lossy impedance matching devices, 50 watts into the antenna structure might be wasting 25 watts in heat somewhere. But you would be able to find that out by touching it afterwards to see if anything is hot or looking at it with a thermal imaging camera. So very, very few antennas these days have lossy materials in them. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Very good, Dick. Well, Chris is in the chat room, so he's giving me a little back and forth. And one of the things he mentioned is would the four separate vertical antennas interact in any bad way? Now, I personally have a fan dipole that I use for HF work, which I love. It really lets me get to a lot of bands, but I've noticed that when the weather changes, they do tend to couple slightly differently, and their resonance kind of shifts. So that's a curiosity I have as well, that would something like this be a little bit more sensitive to weather changes?
Okay. Those whips, absolutely dry in the desert, or soaking wet with beads of water on it in a jungle, no real change in resonant frequency or radiation impedance. Nothing changes. Droplets of water on a quasi full size antenna, that doesn't change. When you do get a change with water, water is getting into some more critical position at the base of the antenna, where there is a close spacing between the center conductor of the coax and the outer shield, because it isn't properly weatherproofed or whatever. Water getting into some critical location like that can make the antenna behave differently on a wet versus a dry day. But water on the antenna itself, no, that's not it. So it's not the whips interfering with each other or being sensitive to water. It's at the place where there is a close spacing between a hot lead and ground, or a place where water can get into it and you have to wait until it dries out. So with proper weatherproofing and proper physical design, so that there isn't close spacing with a droplet of water between the two, you know, If you could drop us a water that are almost bridging the gap between the hot center conductor and the shield of the coax cable, then your antenna will behave very differently on a wet day versus a dry day. And whether it's feeding one whip or four whips is a red herring. It's not the real function. That's a bunch of guesses on my part on that one, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that's as good a reason as any. My thought process was that with a heightened humidity during rain, the dielectric constant separating the different elements is a little bit different, and so the capacitive coupling is a little bit different. But yours is as good as mine.
That's a good logical sounding conclusion, and I think it's not true, Roy. You don't have that. If the whips were a quarter of an inch apart, and you got droplets of water on one, almost bridging the gap and changing the capacitance between the two, yes, you would get a change in the tuning. But with an inch of spacing between them, for instance, and the water droplet is only a 16th of an inch, water at these frequencies doesn't do anything. And as long as it's not bridging a gap where it can be adding a lot of capacitance between objects that are very, very closely spaced, water on the radiator itself is not the factor. It's some other place the water is getting that you don't want it to be there. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Chris responded that he's having a hard time visualizing how the signal can resonate on all four different size antennas at the same time. And as I think you'll explain to him, maybe I'm wrong, it doesn't quite work that way. That different length fan dipoles especially will have different impedances, and it will kind of auto-select the impedance, will let the current flow to the resonant structure for that frequency and not the other elements that are non-resonant. But you can say it better than me, unless I'm completely wrong.
No, you're right, Roy, and I'm going to use slightly different wording, but you're right. If I've got four different resonators and four different frequencies, frequency number 1, 2, 3, and 4, when I'm on frequency 1 and resonator number 1 is providing the correct impedance because it is resonating, 95% of the power goes down antenna number 1 because you're on frequency number 1. The other three antennas are so far mistuned because they're tuned to some other frequency that they take an extremely high standing ratio. The standing wave ratio in this case represents a nearly open circuit, and no signal will flow down the other components. The signal will not flow into the non-resonant antennas. The fact that they're there is almost irrelevant. They're adding a tiny bit of capacitance, but no real energy goes into them. So four separate whips, four separate lengths for the four separate frequencies are really a four bandpass filter assembly. The antenna itself will accept energy on its resonant frequency. It's bandpassing. The other three frequencies, it's as if you had a band stop filter on each of those frequencies. The signal will not flow down a non-resonant antenna unless it's the only thing there, and now you've got an antenna tuner that's working real hard to try to feed that crazy impedance. So the signal only goes down the correct wire, and it ignores all the others. It's one of the places where Mother Nature helps you. She doesn't fight you on this one. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Well, Chris seems to be pleased with that one. And it's sort of a shame that there's no simple, easy way to offer a visualization of RF energy. I mean, we're used to visualization of electromagnetism in the visual light mode. But it's very difficult to find guys who have built jury-rigged devices so that you can get a sense of what the RF emissions are kind of doing other than 3D emulations and such. I've seen a couple of YouTubes where they've tried to do it with Wi-Fi and been somewhat successful. It's a shame that there's not a simpler, easier path to something like that.
Yeah, RF energy is so low in frequency compared to the visual frequencies, there's no way you can look at an antenna and find out that 50 watts is going into wire number one, and only a milliwatt is going into the other three wires of the four-wire antenna, if you know what I mean, the four whips. Yeah, there's no way your eyes can see that. There's a slight exception to this. There was a man who was building a sheet of material that had RF lossy. It was a sheet of very thin carbon granules on a an insulated backplane, and it was made out of material that as you change the temperature, it changes its color. There are kinds of materials that you put your hand on the material, the heat of your hand heats up the material and changes its physical appearance, changes its color. So there was a person that was trying to make the RF equivalent of that, so that as the RF energy is flowing down the wire, it's creating local heating of that sheet of material, and in that vicinity, the sheet of material is changing its color. Very difficult to do, expensive. It wasn't a very successful product, so it hasn't become something you can buy yet. It's a good concept. Somebody's eventually going to do that, so that you'll lay the sheet of material against your four dipoles, and it will show you which ones have RF energy by the sheet of material changing its physical, its optical characteristics. But right now, that doesn't exist. And in this particular antenna, you need so many square inches or square feet of it, I guarantee it would be expensive. So for the time, and I guess you could also put the little neon bulbs hanging all kinds of places on the wires and get a little bit of a hint as to the neon bulbs lighting up. Let me drop it. In the case of an HF antenna, you sometimes can hold a neon bulb, a fluorescent light tube near it, with your hand at one end of the fluorescent tube and the other end of the fluorescent tube near the antenna, and you'll get some lighting. Occasionally you can do that. I haven't seen anybody do that on VHF frequencies. Maybe somebody makes a small fluorescent tube you could do that with. But visualizing RF energy is tough. There are ways you can put instrumentation there and sense the current and sense the voltage with the instrumentation, but it doesn't give you a warm, fuzzy feeling because your eye doesn't see the real RF energy itself. It sure would be nice to see the RF energy flowing down the wire, but right now that's a dream. We've got to concentrate on that one. I guarantee there is a solution out there. It's not an easy solution. Someday we're going to have a solution to that one, I believe, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW, because there's such a drastic need for it. You got it, Roy.
AC2GS, I certainly hope so, Dick. It not only would it have a lot of research uses and practical uses, it would be a great teaching tool as well. And I'm reminded somewhat, we mentioned this a while ago, about these magnetic plastic sheets that have small iron filings impregnated in oil and suspended between two plastic layers, and you can actually see the magnetic lines of force by placing this sheet next to a magnet. It would be lovely to have some type of device that kind of simulated that for radio frequency emission. But you never know. Guys in the lab are coming up with new things every day.
Yeah, I own one of those magnetic sheet detectors, and they work fairly nice. But they're looking at a steady-state magnetic field. And there's not enough magnetic field on an RF circuit, and could that operate on RF? I think the answer is no. Back to you, Roy, and I think you've got another mailbag, as I remember. You got it, Roy.
KC2HBR.
HBR, start off with your name and tell us your comment, sir.
All right. Well, good evening, gentlemen. My name is John, and my comment is, Dick, I heard you mentioning about the light bulb, the fluorescent light, and holding it next to the antenna, and you could get it to light up once in a while. My question is this, Dick. when I was younger, going back to my teen years, early 20s, I used to fool around on, just like a lot of other hams, on the 11-meter band. And I know some of my friends on their mobile setups used to have, I guess they'd call them 9-foot stainless steel whips. And they used to attach a little light to the top. And you would know when they were